call cause number 1319265CV, Vantage Texas versus Christopher Gonzalez, consolidated with cause number 1319371CV, Christopher Gonzalez versus Vantage Bank Texas, formerly known as International Bank and Prestige Luxury Homes.
As the court is aware, Vantage Bank is both the appellant and appellee in these consolidated proceedings. Appellant appealed the temporary injunction order entered in May 24, 2019, precluding Vantage Bank from foreclosing on a residential property and precluding a third party or an additional party to this lawsuit, Prestige, from evicting Christopher Gonzalez from that same residential property. Vantage Bank filed this appeal and asserted its main issue as to whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in granting Gonzalez's requested temporary injunction against Vantage Bank. Subsumed within that same very issue, Vantage Bank also asserted that the TI order was void for failure to comply with Rule 683 to set it for trial and 684 to set a bond. Additionally, Vantage Bank challenged whether or not the TI was properly granted for failure to comply with the standards set forth in Butinara versus Ford, whether or not the plaintiff had pled and a probable right of recovery and proven same against Vantage, whether or not there was imminent and irreparable harm by Gonzalez in the event the requested relief was not granted, for which there was no recovery as a matter of law. Initially, there was no cause of action pled against Vantage Bank. As this court knows, there was an amended petition filed. That amended petition asserts the very same causes of action and factual pattern that are currently pending and set forth in an Hidalgo County District Court lawsuit. Those causes of action against Vantage Bank arise out of a promissory note and related documents pertaining to that transaction.
You know, those causes of action in the Hidalgo County proceeding with discovery and preparing for trial, or what's their status?
Yes, they are proceeding, they are preparing for trial, and we are supposed to go to trial March 16th.
Okay.
In connection with those causes of action, that are the very same, and the fact pattern the very same. This is a breach of contract, conversion cause of action, alleged violations of the DTPA. The court may properly consider the amended pleading, and we are not arguing that they cannot. However, what we do argue is that the court take note of the dominant jurisdiction over those causes of action that were properly pled in Hidalgo County that are exact duplicates and mirror those claims subsequently pled in Cameron County.
How did the case get to Hidalgo County when the property is in Cameron County?
Because the initial dispute was filed or initiated in Hidalgo County by Prestige Luxury Homes. Prestige Luxury Homes is a home builder who contracted with Gonzalez for the construction of a new home. Prestige sued both Gonzalez pursuant to the contract being consummated in Hidalgo County and also pursuant to terms and conditions of venue pertaining to the agreements that were prepared by Vantage Bank. At no time was venue in Hidalgo County contested as to the particular issues before that court.
Do we have a mandatory venue situation?
As the pleadings stand in Cameron County, no, we don't. Because the pleadings in Cameron County are exact duplicates of those in Hidalgo. And each of the claims in Cameron County, as exact duplicates of those in Hidalgo County, seek monetary damages and identify monetary damages as a basis for relief. The claims asserted against Vantage are, simply put, that Vantage Bank improperly paid out $95,000 in forged draw requests to Prestige. That dollar amount is quantifiable. It is clear that Gonzalez's claims in in Cameron County as exact duplicates of those in Hidalgo County, they're ancillary. So the dominant rule of dominant jurisdiction applies. As confirmed recently, I guess in the last 2 weeks, by the Texas Supreme Court in the Red Fox case.
With regard to the order, you've argued that it's void due to the lack of a trial date, which of course Mr. Gonzalez has conceded, and you've also made an argument with regard to the bond, and that's in dispute. So Mr. Gonzalez is arguing that he did post a bond. And we see in the record that in his attempt to dissolve the injunction, there was an order stating that the $500 bond paid for the temporary restraining order was sufficient for the temporary injunction. But there's no indication that that order was ever signed. Do you?
That is correct.
Because your position was that it has not been expressly authorized by the court. Otherwise, it could have been sufficient, the $500 bond posted for the temporary restraining order, correct?
Yes, it could have been sufficient. I'm sorry, you're causing the podium to bounce. I apologize. It was distracting. Yes, there are circumstances in which the bond can carry over, and that is when you comply with the precedent of the order expressly stating that the bond placed for the TRO carries over to the TI order. There is no evidence in the record that that ever occurred. And so their argument fails as a matter of law.
But there's an order in the record, correct? Again, the question is, was it signed?
It was never signed.
Okay.
Okay, so we could sufficiently say, you guys have agreed this order's void. So it's out because it doesn't have a trial date. But your position is, even if we decide that, we should decide the other issues as well, because in the interest of judicial economy, we know they're going to go back and get a new one, is your concern, correct?
Exactly. And to take it even further, we know for a fact that they are arguing that they have posted bond and that bond is sufficient. It's our position that no, it is not sufficient. They've already made it very clear that they want to go back and seek additional temporary injunctive relief. We have no problem with them actually doing that so long as they adhere to the rules of notice and service, which actually formed the basis of the trial court denying their emergency motion. Within that, in the interest of judicial economy, when we take into consideration the underlying facts and causes of action as we now know them, as they've now been pled, they still can't meet the Butenara-Ford criteria.
One of the deficiencies, it seemed like, in the order, the injunction order, was that it was not specific enough. Is it possible, or is it that connected to the argument that there is no probable relief? I don't know if my question's...
I understand.
Me through.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. Are those arguments somehow interrelated?
Correct.
Potentially, yes. And the reason being is, as far as probable right to relief and being specific enough, what we knew at the trial court level at the time the initial TI was entered is that Mr. Gonzalez did not have title to the property. Prestige had already foreclosed. There is no probable right of recovery when that action has already occurred. That also addresses imminent harm. Also, at the trial court level, he never alleges a cause of action against the bank that it breached any of its own loan documents. Everything that he alleged at the trial court level pertained solely to a claim that could be quantified in monetary damages. What we want to do is keep from coming back to the Court of Appeals to clarify all of these other issues, which we know will arise. The contention about the bond, whether or not they met the three criteria in Butenara versus Ford.
And the only argument being advanced for us not considering those issues is the trap rule that Mr. Gonzalez has argued that we should be making this decision solely on the order being void for lack of a trial date.
Well, when taking that into consideration, that's not exactly what 47.1 says. Yes, 47.1 wants you to narrow the scope and be brief. However, the case law that they cite does not stand for the premise that the Court of Appeals only consider one issue. And in fact, we cited three different specific instances within our brief where the court specifically voided a TI based upon a 683 defect and some other substantive issue, such as failure to be specific enough, failure to post a bond, failure to meet the Bucnara criteria. So we disagree with their 47.1 argument that this court should only consider the issue that there is not a trial setting, because we fundamentally know right now there's another error. They have refused to concede the issue about the bond. They have not addressed our other issues pertaining to the Bucnara criteria.
And your challenge to the appeal filed by Mr. Gonzalez, did you challenge jurisdiction in any way? Did you raise jurisdiction? I don't recall seeing that in your...
No. As to Mr. Gonzalez's appeal of the court's denial of his emergency relief, no. We did not challenge that on jurisdictional basis.
Okay. Do you think we have jurisdiction?
There's an issue as to whether or not the court does have jurisdiction. I believe, yes. The Hidalgo County Court, as this court has already adjudicated, I believe in Jay Williamson, that the court of dominant jurisdiction controls the decision making as to these particular issues. Additionally, there is an issue with regard to standing even of Mr. Gonzalez. He no longer owns title to the property. The very thing that he seeks to preclude the bank from doing is foreclosing on a piece of property that he does not have title to. He no longer owns. And as far as his occupancy of same, he's either a tenant at sufferance or a trespasser.
What is the status of the title as between the bank and the builder?
Well, notice that the builder did not file a TRO or a TI or seek any relief against the bank to stop its foreclosure. Prestige had foreclosed on a mechanics and material men's lien. They were a junior lien holder. The bank was the primary and superior lien holder. Because of the actions of Gonzalez, we've not been able to foreclose on our lien, which is superior, and against a party that currently has title. Gonzalez does not.
Okay.
I would address the issues that Gonzalez has asserted in connection with waiver and estoppel. The court knows you can neither waive nor estop a void order back into in existence. As to what happened at the trial court level with the court denying the emergency motion for relief, the court did so as a matter of law based upon procedure. They failed to comply with the local rules regarding notice in the case of an emergency hearing, and they failed to comply with the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. Contained within Vantage Bank's response, Vantage Bank purely objected to the hearing going forward based upon procedural defects pertaining to service and notice.
But if you had the opportunity to get the order dissolved at that point in time, what was your preference for not doing so? Because you knew you were just going to have to file another appeal? Or?
Well, there were several reasons. One was proceeding with inadequate notice on pleadings to which we were never served with. We only found out about the amended pleading at 11:58 p.m., the night before the July 25th hearing. And it wasn't because we were served, it's because we checked the docket sheet. We never received a notice of the hearing. We only found out about it because we checked the docket sheet. All of it really had to pertain to us being able to be prepared to present witnesses and argument and authority as to a whole new TI hearing.
Because Mr. Gonzalez was there with witnesses that day, ready to proceed, I gathered from what the record shows.
Yes, he was ready to proceed. At no time did the court ever say, Mr. Gonzalez, you can't come back and refile under a different set of circumstances. The court expressly stated, I find no emergency here to grant this motion, which was threefold. An emergency motion to take place on July 25th without 3 days notice, to which we didn't even have the benefit of 2 days, to dissolve the TRO and to enter a new TI. And again, the court is also correct. Potentially, we could be back here on the same issues. But as of that date, the thinking of Vantage Bank was, we are not prepared.
Got it.
Did you all object to trial or at the hearing on lack of 3 day notice?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to start off by just addressing the emergency situation that the Vantage Bank, I guess, hangs their hat on with respect to why this judge denied the emergency relief requested by Mr. Gonzalez.
Counsel, before you get into that.
Yes, Your Honor.
One of the concerns I have is the jurisdiction of this court over, since this is an interlocutory appeal, we clearly have jurisdiction over injunctions, but this is a temporary order that I don't see that we have jurisdiction over. Is there, please respond to.
Yes, Your Honor.
First,
my position on the matter is there's no jurisdiction over Vantage Bank's appeal because it's moot. This court has jurisdiction over my consolidated appeal and my issues on appeal because I'm appealing the denial of a temporary injunction. That's what it is. So under the interlocutory statute 5114, you can appeal either the granting or the denial of temporary injunction. When the court signed its order, it denied the application Mr. Gonzalez has made for the denial of the temporary injunction, which is
It was an emergency motion for a temporary injunction? I didn't look at that in the record.
Well, it's twofold, Your Honor. Here's the quandary. We concede that the order was void, and it's void ab initio because it did not comply with 683. So in an attempt to resolve that issue, we go to the court and say, Your Honor, you need to get rid of, that's a void order. We're going to put on or request an application for a temporary injunction proceed at this time. But I want to address the emergency, if I may, Your Honor, the emergency behind it, okay? Vantage says this is void. And a void order is a nullity in and of itself. It's as if it does not exist. It's nothing. It is void. And so if it's a void order, and we knew they were going to foreclose and they want to foreclose, then there's nothing prohibiting them from foreclosing. The only thing that Vantage Bank has said about why they're not continuing to foreclose is because they said, we're going to honor the injunction. For all I know, they can say that today, but then tomorrow they may have a discussion and say, well, wait a minute, you know what? That temporary injunction order is void. Do we really have to follow it? It's a void order. And then what position are we in? That's why there was an emergency. The emergency was you have an order that they don't have to respect. They're telling us that they're respecting it, but we're not going to take their word for it because for whatever reason, you get another bank president or somebody else comes over this on the collection side of it and say, we're going to foreclose anyway because that's a void order. Are we sure it's void? Yeah. Okay, go ahead. You can't be in contempt of a void order. It's void. And so the only way that we could resolve that exigency was to move the way that we did. But this is very critical, and I want the court to pay very particular attention to this. On page 8 of my brief, I go through the dialogue between the court and Mr. Haynes, who was counsel for the bank. And in that particular case, and remember, their whole defense to this thing was, there's no emergency. What's the emergency? There's no emergency, judge. And the judge says, well, what's the emergency? I'm going to tell you why the judge believed that there was no emergency. The testimony goes as follows. The court addressing Mr. Haynes for Vantage Bank. Okay, so you appealed the fact that there's a temporary injunction. You don't want it, right, Mr. Haynes? Mr. Haynes, I appealed the temporary injunction, yes. I would have liked to have been able to foreclose on the collateral. The court, okay, but if there's no injunction, then you can foreclose, right? Mr. Haynes, potentially, yes, Your Honor. The court, okay, but you're asking to have it dissolved, void, no? Mr. Haynes says, no. What we have done, Your Honor, and this is where it is, where it's misleading, and then he goes on to describe whatever it is that he's describing, and I don't really understand. But he's telling the court, Judge, we're not, the judge asked, are you asking to have it dissolved, void? Mr. Haynes says no. Okay, my understanding is if you tell the judge, I'm not gonna go try to undo this injunction. This is July 25th. Mm-hmm. On July 5th, if you look at the prayer for relief on Vantage Bank's appeal, they ask for one thing. They ask this court to dissolve the injunction. And so, at the end of the hearing, the court asks, so you want the order to stay in place while the appeal is pending? Mr. Haynes, I would like for that order to stay in place. So, if you tell the judge, Judge, we're not seeking to dissolve it, and Judge, we want to keep it in place, well, then of course the judge is going to say, well, what's the emergency? But they didn't tell the judge, Your Honor, in our Court of Appeals relief, we asked for the court to dissolve it, so we are seeking to dissolve it. And that's the quandary that we've got.
Isn't the context of their argument, though, that they want to have everything considered that they put in their motion, which is more than just obviously the bond and the lack of a trial date, but it's also the heart of the case, which is there's no probable relief that was there, no imminent harm. Isn't that really what they're going for in the context of their argument? I've seen what's subsequent to that, and that's why I'm asking the question.
Well, I would agree with you, Your Honor. Those are their arguments, and that's what they're asserting. But my argument is none of it is relevant at all. And the reason that it's not relevant is because it's a void order. And you can have an order can be void for 5 reasons. I only need one. A void order can be for 2 reasons. That's fine. But once Mr. Gonzalez filed this motion and says, this thing is void, there's no longer a dispute between the party. Because it's not just voidable. It's void ab initio, as if it didn't occur, a nullity under the law. And so this isn't going to be a situation where the court is signing an injunction order and then signing another one. The way the law looks at this, because it's a void order, the court's never done it because it's void ab initio. And so...
Well, but the under TRAP 29.5, it states that after an interlocutory appeal is filed, which is what we have here, the trial court may make further orders, blah, 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 except they can't make one that interferes with or impairs the jurisdiction of the appellate court or effectiveness of any relief sought or that may be granted on appeal. Couldn't that be a basis for the trial court having denied your requested relief and therefore not be an abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor, because it's void ab initio. It's as if it doesn't exist. That rule is in the context of you have an order, an injunction order, and it says you can't do A, B, and C. If C becomes changed, the circumstances change, and the court needs to, you have to come back in. And for whatever reason, C has other implications, either on appeal or affecting third parties or whatever the circumstance may be. The trial court has to restrain its I guess, modification in those instances, not to disrupt other ancillary things that may be ongoing at the time. Mm-hmm. But in this case, you have no A, you have no B, you have no C, you have nothing. You have a void order.
Well, except the trial court did have a basis for just saying, look, we're not going to proceed because, as was argued, they didn't have adequate notice. They didn't have time to prepare. You know, so we're not, there's no emergency here, so we're not proceeding without even consideration of whether the order was void or not or any of that, any merit to it. He's basically, or she, I don't know who the trial judge was, but is saying we're not proceeding here today because you didn't give proper notice and they're not prepared.
Well, Your Honor, I beg to differ for two reasons. The first one is the court held the hearing and they showed up. And you can ask for a hearing on an emergency basis. Mm-hmm. And it's up to the judge to either, I mean, the judge could have said, I'm not going to hear it. The judge could have said, I'm not going to hear that emergency motion, period. But that's not what happened. What happened was he called the case, the appearances were made, the issues were presented to the court, and then it made a ruling. And it made its ruling because the court said there's no emergency here. Well, why isn't there an emergency? I just told you why. Mr. Haynes told the judge, we're not seeking to dissolve it, and we want it to stay in place. So if you tell the judge that, well, of course he's not going to think there's an emergency. But if Mr. Haynes would have said, yes, judge, we're asking for it to be dissolved so we can proceed with the foreclosure, and no, I don't want you to keep it in place, then that would have changed the circumstances. But that's not the fact pattern that we're dealing with. And so to me, that's it. That's the answer. The whether they're prepared or not, or whether they're or not, they were there. And I understand
what they're saying. Okay, so let's say we agree with you. It's void. Why? On the basis that you've said, what's to keep us from considering the other grounds that they're asserting that you're just going to go back and do and they're going to bring back up? I mean, none of that's going to change, really.
Well,
the facts are the facts. And
let me ask a question in that regard, because it's something puzzling to me, too. Obviously, you have a junior and a senior lien position. Mm-hmm. The junior position has already been foreclosed on well before the interlocutory judgment came to be, so you've already had an ownership change. How do you get to imminent harm and to probable right of recovery when there is no possession of the property at this point in time?
Well, I disagree with that, Your Honor, and two reasons.
My way. No.
First one, if you look at the pleadings, there's fraud and forgery pled all over against Prestige, okay? Prestige was forging Christopher Gonzalez's signature on the payment draw request so that the bank could pay him. And one of the claims against the bank is, well, you're not supervising that situation because they're just giving you paper without you confirming that the actual work was done. That's the fraud part of it. But the other part of it, Your Honor, to address your claim is Christopher Gonzalez, and it's in the record, it's not disputed, it's in the reporter's record, has submitted he paid at least $70,000 to fix the home, or to continue the construction of the home when Prestige left, okay? Secondly, he's been living there and it's his homestead. So my argument is, and the cases are clear, Your Honor, fraud vitiates everything it touches. Fraud has touched this situation. Christopher Gonzalez has at the minimum an equitable lien in the property based upon the amount of money he put into it to finish the construction. He may even have and I looked up the proper name for it, but a purchase money resulting trust in it because of what he's done in order to make the improvements on the home. And so.
But isn't that between him and Prestige?
Right, but what I'm trying to explain to the court is that he has the equitable interest to provide him with standing to contest the foreclosure, based upon the undisputed fact that he has submitted more than $70,000 into the construction of this home on this property. And he lives there, and it's his homestead.
Did he actually declare it a homestead?
As far as I know, Your Honor, I cannot answer that question because I don't know. I apologize, Your Honor. But
it's not in the record.
I believe that the homestead question is based on intent, and I can tell you that whether or not he filed the homestead exemption prior to the time that the foreclosure occurred, I don't know. But I can tell you that it is his intention that is his homestead. And so,
but can you base, you can make a claim like that just based on intention?
I believe that is the law, Your Honor.
Notwithstanding the deed of trust and the M&M liens?
I believe.
Contract?
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, that there's legal title and equitable title. We're saying that this foreclosure was fraudulent, and that's why you can throw it out, because we've pled fraud against Prestige for all the reasons that I've discussed. And part of it is them doing this foreclosure, because Prestige is saying that they, under the mechanics lien, are saying, well, we're going to foreclose for $30,000 because you didn't pay it. So now they have title, and the bank is above them, and they can't affect the bank's title. Fine. What I'm telling you, Your Honor, is that we have a fraud claim against Prestige, and that fraud claim is going to knock out the foreclosure because we have equitable interest in the property. That's how we have standing. And if you look at the facts of the case, the way that they're pled, if you look at the transcript, I believe, of the first injunction hearing, Christopher Gonzalez talks about how much money he put into it and that he lives there and so forth. And so what I'm telling the Your Honors is that to address the standing issue, he has standing to do this because of the equitable principles that I've alluded to. But, you know, based upon the amount of money that he put in there, that he's living there, it's his intent to make that his homestead, and that's his house.
I don't recall seeing any cases cited. Do you have any case authority that shows you can vitiate or remove a foreclosure after the fact on fraud?
Your Honor, it is not in my brief. I did not put that in there. I mean, if the court would like, I could submit that post-submission, but it is not in my brief. But that is the basis by which he can claim standing.
And how does that excuse payment to Vantage, though?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
How does all of that excuse payment to Vantage?
I don't believe that it... I'm not certain, Your Honor. I don't really know how to address that question at this point, just because I'm tied to the issues on appeal at this point, but I don't know how to answer that question, Your Honor. I just don't. But getting back to the appeal... What our contention is that this basis that Vantage is arguing about, there was no emergency, and the court said that there was no emergency. The only reason they said that is because Mr. Haynes gave the judge inaccurate information. That's the only reason he made that. That's undisputed. I just read it to you. So you get rid of that. The next thing is that the judge abused its discretion because he didn't void this order. Because the law says it's void, we're asking for it to be voided. He didn't void it. That's an abuse of the law. He didn't follow the law. He wasn't guided by the principles of the law. He said he wasn't going to do it. So that's an abuse of discretion. I think that's clear. Secondarily to that is when counsel for Mr. Gonzalez attempted to proceed on his application for temporary injunction, present his witnesses, the court said, that's it. Y'all are excused. You can go now. The court didn't let him do that. And all of the law that I do cite in a brief says you really can't do that. You have to allow the parties to at least present the different...
But wasn't the trial court in a position knowing that if he had proceeded and allowed you to put on this evidence, Advantage was at a disadvantage because they weren't prepared and they didn't have their own witnesses? Then he would possibly have abused his discretion that way.
Well, Your Honor,
seems like he was kind of put between a rock and a hard place.
Well, I think, I don't disagree that it was a tough decision, Your Honor. But you know, all of the things that that I am identifying establishes the emergency, because again, it's a void order. If they decide to say, you know what, we're going to foreclose anyway, we only have their agreement. There's no Rule 11 of that. They just said that they're respecting it, but they have there's no requirement under the law for them to do it. And so we have to take the position, because there's no other position to take, is, okay, we're going to wait and see what they do. Maybe they're going to foreclose, maybe we're not. No, that's not the way Mr. Gonzalez wanted to proceed. He wanted to ensure the fact that he was able to protect his interest, that the money and his love for this piece of property to stay there. That's why he did that. But the law, and I was about to cite a case, but it goes like this, Your Honor. The court was not empowered to deny him the opportunity to present his evidence in support of his injunction. All the cases that are at site say that, and that is an abuse of discretion for the court not to allow him to do it. It seemed like he was going to let him do it, but then the court says, I'm not going to change my mind. You know what? You all are excused. And so, I mean, the counsel for Mr. Gonzalez specifically asked the court to do it, and the court denied that. And that is also an abuse of discretion. And then finally, I don't have much time, Your Honor, but, you know, the other thing, and I go back to what Mr. Haynes said to the court. I mean, they're taking two diametrically opposed positions. And so my first position on Vantage's appeal is, number one, their appeal's moot. It's moot when, because we agreed that it's void. So there's no dispute for this court to resolve. What's the dispute? A court dissolves disputes. Well, I say it's void. They say it's void. There's no dispute. And the law says it's void. So it's really no dispute. So that goes away. So
well, they want us to address those other issues that they know you're going to just go back and bring back, and they're going to have to bring back up.
Right, Your Honor. But you can grant them complete relief with one issue that's undisputed. And the law says if you can do that, you don't address the other issues, 47.1. It says if the other issues are necessary for the disposition of the case, it's not.
So Vantage has argued that we can do so in the interest of judicial economy.
Well, I don't know.
Pretty
well,
broad.
Well, I don't know if it's, I mean, I would argue the judicial economy is, it, you know, you rule on one issue and you're done. I mean, I just think it's a one and done situation, Your Honor. You can give them complete relief because if you look at Vantage's prayer for relief, they only ask for one thing. Dissolve the injunction.
So let's say we agree with you and say, okay, it's void just for that. Don't address the other issues. You go back and you're going to put on your evidence. But even if we do as Vantage is asking and address those other issues favorably to them, for argument's sake here, does that keep you from going back and trying again?
No, Your Honor.
So either way, you're going to do it, right?
I don't think we have a choice, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I don't think, and with that, my time is up, Your Honor, but on that basis, I request that the court dissolve the injunction, remand the case so that Mr. Gonzalez can proceed with his application for temporary injunction, Your Honor, and that you grant Christopher Gonzalez's appeal in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed.
I'm Allison Haynes. I'm Ms. Haynes. Mr. Haynes is my husband, Richard Haynes. He was nowhere near that courtroom on that day. It was me.
I made those
arguments. As the court correctly recognized, there was dialogue in the reporter's record both before and after that excerpt that was read to the court by opposing counsel. We made it clear in our written response, to which we stayed up all night preparing, that our basis for objecting to a motion that was styled and argued plaintiff's emergency motion for relief to A, have a July 25th hearing, B, dissolve a temporary injunction, C, issue a new injunction. Did the court not in fact decide at that hearing that we were not going to proceed? The court did. The court denied A, the expedited hearing. They want to argue that the court, by virtue of taking up the motion to address issue A, means the court has to address all issues. The court decided there was no emergency. Let's talk about emergency. There was no impending emergency. As stated in the reporter's record, Chapter 51 of the Texas Property Code requires 21 days notice to any foreclosure. You must properly post and give notice. There are strict procedural requirements. In order for the bank to foreclose, we could not go out the next day and foreclose. We would have to act in accordance with the Texas Property Code. There's no evidence in the record, and in fact, the evidence is to the contrary, that the bank had not noticed this property for foreclosure. As the Court of Appeals is well aware, most of the issues that come up is when a party goes and gets an ex parte TRO at the last minute when they know who opposing counsel is who posted the property for foreclosure. There was no impending foreclosure. 21 days notice. Let's talk about lack of emergency again. If you look at the declaration that was signed by Mr. Gonzalez, it was signed on July 19th. The motion was filed on July 22nd. Mr. Gonzalez and his counsel sat on that motion for 3 days. 3 days. We have a fundamental right to both notice and service. It is recognized in the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, and it is recognized in the Cameron County local rules. As to waiver and estoppel and us arguing inconsistent relief, we were not. We addressed the court in Reporter's Record, pages 7 and 8, advised that there were multiple issues, not just an issue of a void order. The court stopped us in addressing the court at one point in time when we were going to identify those issues. You cannot revive a void order into existence by waiver or estoppel, which is what they are arguing. They are additionally arguing that this court should only resolve one issue. One issue, when we know that that order is void for two reasons. They have refused to concede the second reason about the bond, and we also know that they cannot meet the Butinara criteria. We have additional issues with regard to dominant jurisdiction. We know that we are going to be back here. To argue that 470.47.1 operates in a vacuum is false. It is absolutely false. As a matter of judicial economy, this court should, as courts have done in many other instances, address both the procedural and substantive issues raised in appeal. As cited in Independent Capital Management versus Collins, holding both the temporary injunction was void for lack of compliance with Rule 683 and that the appellee failed to show irreparable injury. Kaufman versus Morales, holding that both a temporary injunction order was overly broad and that it was void for lack of compliance with Rule 683. Also cited, In re IEF. Motion for legislative continuance was defective for lack of statutorily required affidavit. However, matters of judicial economy compel us to reach the merits of the motion and eliminate unnecessary grounds for contention in the event that appellee were to file a new motion for continuance with an affidavit. We would additionally cite, as the court has correctly acknowledged, that Gonzalez is arguing outside his pleadings on appeal in connection with this homestead exemption. It's not properly before the court.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case will be under submission.